KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for tuning in today. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of a fascinating new study and examination of the impact of the Internet and technology on people's lives. The author is Richard Lanham, and the book is called The Economics of Attention. The book, by its very title, really itself sets the stage for the discussion. It is pretty much received wisdom at this point that the Internet and technology has bombarded the world with information. There's not much new in that statement until you start taking a look at what it means for people who are trying to discern what information to follow, what the information means, and really make sense of the cavalcade. And that's where Professor Lanham's book comes into play. The Economics of Attention, by its name, suggests the focus here, which is attention itself. The attention that human beings are able to pursue in connection with the technology, the attention spans that human beings have when they attempt to decipher information, how much time they take to do all those things, and really how information and culture itself is created are all of the topics discussed in this book, and so many more. One of the fascinating things about Professor Lanham's book is that one of the interesting things he does, in fact, is, and what we'll talk about, are what he calls background conversations, where Professor Lanham takes us behind the scenes, as it were, to take a look at how the book was created, where Professor Lanham's thought processes developed to get to the point where he makes the many arguments and points that he makes in this book, and where it leads us. So it's a very rich book, both for people who are looking at technology from the standpoint of information overloads, but also for, I think, for researchers and people who are aspiring authors and authors to look very closely at how a book like this is created. Professor Lanham is known, and in his background is in rhetoric, and he's published many books in that area. He is a professor emeritus of English at UCLA, and he also is president of a company called Rhetorica, which is a consulting firm. I'm very excited to have Professor Lanham on today to discuss his book and really to explore some of the permutations of his work, what the work means, and really the ultimate question, which is, what are we doing in a society where attention itself is subject to scarcity? So when we return from a short music break, I'll be very excited to begin the discussion with Professor Richard Lanham, author of the book, The Economics of Attention. Well, if I've done my job correctly, on the other end of the phone is Richard Lanham. Richard, are you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Terrific. Richard, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and taking the time to discuss your fascinating book. Let's start right off with a basic question that I ask of all authors, which is the title of the book. What is the meaning of the title of your book, The Economics of Attention?
Well, in your introductory statement, you talked about the central problem, which is that in an information economy, what is really in short supply is attention. And economics is all about the allocation of scarce commodities. And what's happened now is that the scarce commodity is not a commodity, but human attention. And so how do you allocate it? And this seems to, if you think about it and you say, well, suppose this, the item in short supply is attention, who in Western culture has classically has allocated attention, and it turns out that it's a different set of people from the conventional economists. So we're talking about a different kind of economy and how it relates to the conventional economy. In terms of my training in rhetoric, it means how you can think about rhetoric. Rhetoric is usually defined as the art of persuasion, but you could just as easily call it the economics of attention. It teaches people how to suggest that you should pay attention to one thing rather than another, that you should allocate your attention. So there's that kind of statement. That's one way to what the economics of attention means. I'm continually asked how an English professor gets mixed up with economics, and especially
right.
how somebody interested in rhetoric could possibly be interested in economics. So maybe,
and indeed, the danger of it as well.
Well, it's listen. I know all about that. You're supposed to stick to your last, and
right.
I have lunch with every week with a bunch of economists and people from the law school, and they don't know why I'm there, except that I'm interested in economics for some reason. And when they ask me why are you interested in it, I usually say, well, my mind has a mind of its own, and it's just doing this, and that's in fact true. But I have, you know, people when they're talking about Adam Smith now always say, don't forget he also wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and so there's another side to Adam Smith, but what everybody seems to forget is that his position at the University of Glasgow was as a professor of rhetoric and logic.
Hmm.
And his first book, if you could call it that, some lecture notes that students took down, was on his course on rhetoric. So I'm not the only person who's ever been interested in rhetoric and economics.
Right. And for listeners that aren't familiar, briefly, and I know this is a tough question, but a brief summary of what it means to be a professor of rhetoric.
Well, rhetoric is the history. Rhetoric hasn't always been a synonym for hokum or deception or spin. For most of its history, it was the theory for public speaking and writing. It was invented by the Greeks when they needed to speak up in a democracy, and it's been with us ever since. It has been the basis of Western education in the word for most of its history. So it has an honorable estate that we've only recently forgot about. It is sometimes defined narrowly, which ends up being a discussion of various figures of rhetoric or the ornamental side of it. And I've worked that side of the street. I've compiled a book called A Hand List of Rhetorical Terms with 1,000 of them, so I know about that side.
Right.
But it's also, in its widest sense, a kind of counterstatement to philosophy. Instead of as philosophy tends to do, postulating some kind of utopia in the manner of Plato, it starts out by saying, well, how do people behave, and how can I make them behave differently? That is, it's really a kind of common law versus statute law argument. So it's, in its widest sense, it's all about how people construct social reality by talking to one another.
That background leads to the logical, I think, next question, which is, how does that background, studying the word, as it were, in that manner, impact and color your work leading up to the publication of The Economics of Attention?
Well, I got interested about 20 years ago, maybe more than that, in what happens when words move from print to digital screen. I got a computer in 1981. I didn't know anything about it, but I wanted to make a program to go with a book on stylistic revision that I call Revising Prose. I wanted words to move around on the page and flash and make funny beep beep noises, and I found out that computer couldn't do it, but I could do it some other way. And so ever since then, I've been interested in what happens to words when you turn them loose from the frozen matrix of print and they wander around on a digital screen.
Hmm.
And this got me interested in computer graphics. And I went to one of the early SIGGRAPH computer graphics conferences, and I saw a display of a stick figure, a simulation of a fighter plane landing on a carrier deck. This was in the early 80s.
Hmm.
And when a plane lands on a carrier deck and the carrier is moving sideways as well as forward, it's a complicated computation and one of the early landmarks in computer graphics. But I had an epiphany there. I said, wait a minute, what's going to happen when it's words that land on the page rather than the fighter plane on the carrier deck and start moving around? So that's how I got interested in what now is apparently called digital rhetoric. I had a nice conversation with a scholar from Irvine not long ago, and she said, well, you are the inventor of digital rhetoric. And I said, well, I didn't know that, but I'll take credit for it if you want. I need all the help I can get. But I was trying to figure out what happens. I spent a lot of my time in conventional rhetoric in the university sense, that is composition instruction. I left my respectable life in the English department in 1979 and founded a writing program at UCLA to teach prose composition. And I've done books and these videos, and so I've had this kind of second life in composition, and it was clear that this was going to all change, and that it was going to be, composition should be an instruction in words and images and sounds and how they fit together. Now, what's happening is that the students are going ahead and doing this, and the professors are tagging behind, as though they're catching up a little bit. It's very hard to do in the academic life because the people who deal with words are in one department, the people who deal with images are in a second department, the people who deal with sounds are in a third or fourth department, and as you must know from yourself from living in a university environment, departments don't often talk to each other.
Right.
How do you get these things together? So that was one of the things I have been trying to figure out in my earlier book, The Electronic Word, and in this one.
And that logistical challenge is certainly something that even for putting this radio show together, when I contact guests and have conversations, it's often amazing to me how people may not be aware of the work that someone's doing next door to them or down the hall at different universities. So that's definitely it's a logistical question and one that I think technology can help solve. Before we get into the thesis of the book and some of and we can only really scrape the surface of some of the insights that you offer, I do want to delve a little bit into one of the structural elements of your book that I find quite fascinating and useful, which is this background conversation idea. You know, as I mentioned to you off air, in reviewing the book in preparation for today's interview, I read through the background conversations and actually took the opportunity to purchase some of the books that you mentioned. Talk to the listeners a little bit about, first of all, for those that haven't read the book, what the background conversations are in connection with the book and actually why they're there in the first place.
Okay. The book is really composed of two elements. There are a series of chapters which carry the main argument of the book, and these are interrupted by a series of interchapters called background conversations. The background conversations are about, you know, this book, people always, when you have interviews like this, one of the questions you're usually asked is why did you write this book? And the proper answer is, well, I wanted to share my profound observations with my fellow citizens about X or Y or Z.
But,
who was it? Who was, maybe in the Algonquin New Yorker conversations in the 30s at the Algonquin Hotel, somebody said, the real title of every book that's ever been written is Why the World Should Be More Like Me. But this book is not about that at all. It's about how, if I don't finish this book pretty soon, it'll finish me. I've been trying to put together my thinking about these different poems and reading in these different texts, and the best I could do was in the series of chapters. But at the same time, I wanted to somehow come clean about how I was just wandering around in puzzlements and trying to say, well, maybe there's some light here, and maybe there's some here, and does this thing fit with that thing? And so I normally what you do in a scholarly book is you put these in a series of long footnotes, or you put them in the book itself and make it even harder to read, or you put them in long footnotes or endnotes or some kind of bibliography. And I wanted to do something different from that. I wanted to make it a conversation, and I wanted to say this is where I've been living, and it's by no means been an always a clear process, but maybe you'd come along with me and I'll come clean and tell you how puzzled I've been about some of these things, and maybe you'd find some answers here and maybe you'd find some answers there. So I stumbled somehow through wandering steps and slow to the idea of saying, well, it's really a set of background conversations. You're at the end of your career, Lanham. You can just call it background conversations and not worry about what people will say. So that's what I did. And you're saying that, well, gee, that made me want to go read this or that, means that that's exactly what I wanted it to do. I wanted to open out a conversation. I thought of it, I didn't think of this at the time, I'll tell you the truth, but afterwards I thought, really, this is the influence of the internet, isn't it? That what I want to do is convert a one-way utterance into some kind of conversation.
Right.
And so that's what those are about.
And, you know, and again, I mean, the ease with which people can access information, a topic that's been written about extensively and something that we'll talk about a little bit here, also lends itself to having a background conversations in the book. That is, I was able to simply go on the internet with the book in front of me and in a matter of minutes purchase a half a dozen books in order to, you know, further fill in some of the gaps that I feel I have in my understanding of these issues. So it's a wonderful addition to the book, and especially as compared to your typical footnote, I found it quite enjoyable. Let's turn to the thesis of the book, and I guess I'll open up the discussion this way. Obviously, the focus of your book is on the concept of attention, and perhaps the best question to ask is how you define attention in terms of how we think of it as what people do, giving attention to something, and then how the internet impacts our ability to pay attention to the world around us.
Well, the first thing I'd have to say is that attention can mean a number of things depending on which part of the world you come from. If you're a perception psychologist, it means one thing. If you're a student of rhetoric, it means another. If you're an economist, it means another. It just, in my mind, it means what you focus on, what you are looking at the time. If you let's just take an example of reading a literary text. If you concentrate on what's happening, that's a certain kind of attention. I call that through attention, when you're looking through a text to what's going on underneath it. But you can also notice the language. You can listen to a passage read aloud from a Virginia Woolf novel and say, oh, man, that prose is fantastic. How could she write that way? You're looking, paying a different kind of attention. You're looking at the text rather than through it. I argue in the book that those are really two fundamental kinds of ways to pay attention, and that you can learn a lot by seeing those in the different ways you behave in the world, because you're forever going from one to the other. The same thing is true I'll give you one other example and then ask you whether I'm making sense. I was reading the Wall Street Journal this morning, and I saw a picture of a pocketbook made out of an alligator skin, and they had a series of price comparisons of what this pocketbook cost all over the world, and it was $400 or $500 or $600. And I said to my wife, even though I should have known better, $600 for a pocketbook? And she said, $6,000, more like. But at the same time, in one kind of attention, you're saying this lady must be as nutty as a fruitcake to pay all that money for a pocketbook. On the other hand, she's trying to make a statement about all kinds of stylistic references, and it makes perfect sense to pay $600 or $6,000, depends on how you pay attention. So, but there are lots of other ways that you might define this word, depending on the frame of scholarly reference you use. But those are the two that I bring to it, and that I try to say make some sense in terms of how, for example, contemporary artists have looked at the world. Am I making any sense?
My follow-up question from that really leads to the question of, and so it does make sense. The answer is yes. And if one, let's take a somewhat facile example, but if one chooses to pay no attention to the internet, where do you think attention is still an issue for that person? Do you still think that attention is a problem?
Well, sure. That is to say, it's always going to be a scarce resource, since it was a scarce resource before the internet came on the scene. It was a scarce resource before we had the rich multimedia signal as a means of cultural expression. But I think that So sure, it's always, people are always going to choose to pay attention to one thing rather than another. What varies, I guess, with the onset of the Internet is the breadth of things that they can pay attention to and the speed with which they can move from one to the other. Mm-hmm. And that changes things. I mean, I forgot, to be honest with you, such as the debility of age, which Russian filmmaker it was who experimented with showing a shot of one face and then showing it, that same face, with a sad scene and with a happy scene and so on, and saying that it's the speed with which you move from one to the other that makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly true of how you work from one link to another in the web. So that makes sense. But there's always been maybe this is the place to say this, we've mm-hmm. always hankered after a rich signal, a mixed signal. If you look at the history of Western expression, what people, stuffy professors like me, usually say is, look at this, what's happening on the Internet, they're moving from pictures to sound, and this is the end of life as we know it,
right.
Which is certainly true, but it's not the end of Western cultural expression. It's really the resurrection of it, because if you look back at manuscript culture, for example, they wanted as many pictures as they could afford. They liked to read things aloud in order to get some an audio signal in it. So there's always been a deep desire for a rich signal. Now we have this very rich one, and we don't quite know how to handle it yet. But
right.
We'll soon find out, you know, it'll work itself out.
Yeah, and it certainly is, and whether it's, you know, working itself out for inuring to the benefit of the public or not is, you know, the general user is, of course, one of the ultimate questions that we're still facing today and grappling with. Before I probe some of the points that you make in the book, I do want to ask one definitional question as well, which is you speak of stuff, quote-unquote, and information, quote-unquote, in your book. Perhaps you could define what you mean by those two terms, again, in connection with your book.
Sure. If you think about the history of economics, you can think about it as in three stages. First, there is the stage of agriculture, and then there is the stage of industrialism, and then there is the stage of information. And the first two are based on physical matter, on stuff that you can drop on your foot. And that starts to change, really. It starts to change in Western thinking as soon as we start to change our view about nature.
Mm-hmm.
If we think about nature as stuff, then that's easy, because you've got romantic poetry and all the things which describe nature. But if you think about it as information, and that's what's happening, then everything really, really changes. In an agricultural and an industrial society, nature is matter and energy. But now it's information. You see the same thing in a computer. A computer, the center of the computer is not all of the physical world that you can create and express on it, but the digital code. And the digital code is the real center, and everything else is, in a manner of speaking, a printout.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a kind of reversal. The referent, the central power, is the digital code, and the physical manifestation, the stuff, is derivative. The perfect computer-assisted design and manufacture is the time when I first came along, and I went down to a guy in the engineering school who had the first CAD/CAM system at UCLA, and it was an epiphany like the carrier landing, because what he was doing was saying that here I can make the hull of a boat, I can make all these things, generate them immediately out of a code, and now of course we're doing it with 787 Boeing airplanes and everything else. So from stuff we've moved to information, and that makes an extraordinary difference.
Turning along those lines, turning to some of the points you make in your book, I want to first ask you a bit about the basic idea you have, which is that innovation and productivity itself creates value. I guess a two-part question there, which is how does that fit into your conception of the world as we know it today? And then a corollary question is, in your view, how dangerous is our commodification of information in and of itself?
for the first answer to the first question, I guess, is that I'm just a Friedrich Hayek pupil. I think that if you leave people alone, they will create all kinds of innovations themselves by answering local needs in local times and places. I've got a you mentioned my wall chart on the one of the walls of my computer room with the printing house instruction. We can talk about that if you want to.
Right, the Beatrice Ward.
Beatrice Ward check. I also have a chart from a chair museum in Germany of all the different kinds of styles of chairs. It's partly because I collect Danish furniture, but it's also because it's a perfect instance of how stylistic innovation creates value. It's what the great literary, now pretty much forgotten literary scholar Morris Peckham called non-functional stylistic dynamism, which is simply the way that information, the way that stylistic imitation occurs, and it creates all kinds of value and all kinds of novelty just because of the way it works by itself. You don't have to plan it. It's a spontaneous, evolving system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure what commodification of information means, but if it means trying to own it and then to ration its flow,
yes,
we're back with the copyright issue, and it's absolutely fundamental. And the ways in which that kind of stylistic innovation, which is what artistic creativity really is being, like the way it's being sold off, and people are trying to control and cartel it, is terribly dangerous. I have nothing to add to the brilliant work of your Stanford colleague Lawrence Lessig in this connection, but it's very clear that is true, and that's really the danger of in the copyright world now, because where the value has in an economics of attention, the value moves from objects to the cultural conversation about objects. I learned this, and I had this long sixth chapter in the economics of attention about the Barbie girl case that I worked on as an expert witness. But the lesson of that is that for her, the value of the Barbie girl is not in the physical doll, it's in the conversation that she's created. And that's what Mattel understood that from the beginning. And they said, we own this conversation.
Right.
And when people start staking claims to the cultural conversation, you're in real trouble.
And I think we'll take a music break in a moment, but I think that one of the interesting corollaries you draw in the book is to point out that with respect to electronic books and things like that, where content creators required that if one were to put a copy of the book on two different devices, say, a portable device and your desktop computer, that you had to purchase two copies of the book as an individual, the comparison to the monastic library where the books were chained to the furniture, and the fact that, therefore, you can't get any more drastic than to revert back to the day before the printed word, is, I think, a very humorous but also sad corollary that is quite accurate today. We're going to return after a short music break with Professor Richard Lanham, author of the fascinating work, The Economics of Attention.
Before we return to the conversation with Professor Lanham, I do want to now ask you for money, as I always do. I should add, by the way, that this show is being recorded on January 23rd, for those of you who are listening and are keeping track. January 23rd is the record date. If you love what you're listening to right now, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, news, and public affairs. By visiting kzsu.stanford.edu and clicking on Donate to KZSU, or by emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, you can do your part to make sure our independent sound never dies.
We're back with Richard Lanham. And Richard, I want to turn now to one of the core focuses of your book, which is the issue of attention scarcity. and ask you this question. You know, the idea of filtering information, of making sense of it, is one that where technology is increasingly becoming more sophisticated, and more tools are available to the casual user of the internet to narrow down and drill down on particular topics of interest. Does technology allow for attention to be conserved? And by that I mean the use of search engines, of RSS feeds, of specific types of search engines or lists like Technorati. Do they allow the scarcity element to change? In other words, is the use of technology more than the technology itself the element that creates scarcity?
Does tech allow for attention to be technology allow for attention to be conserved? Sure, that was what Herb Simon said in really one of the first, to this day, one of the only articles on the economics of attention, where he said all these problems are going to be solved by various kinds of robots or nobots or so on that are going to narrow the searches down, and these are getting better and better, and there's no question that they're powerful. So the answer to that is clearly so. Whether it's the use of it that creates scarcity, I'm not sure. I know just what you mean.
I can clarify it. The technology itself has certain elements to it, and those elements may or may not be immutable. But isn't the interaction of the individual with the technology, vis-a-vis use of things like search engines, seems to be the core of what creates the scarcity that you're discussing in your book. And so my question really is that does technology itself inherently include the concept of attention scarcity, or is it how people interact with it that more or less creates the scarcity that you've discussed?
I hope I've made
that clear.
Yep, and I would just have to say both.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how one could say one without the other. A point I want to make apropos this one is that technology, the search engine way, is one way in which we can make more efficient use of the time we have. But one of the other ways is by the intensification of experience. And one of the ways you can do that is you just said it took you 30 seconds to get these books looked up on Amazon. But beyond that, a further point, if you start out by saying I have something that I want to say, something that I want to express, some strain of propositional reasoning that I want to develop, pretty much for most of Western history you had to do that in words. Now you, partly because there's a common digital base in the digital code, you can express yourself in words, you can express yourself music, you can express yourself in images in all kinds of different ways. And I think that means that there will be there has already been a enrichment in the results of our attention, in how much we get for paying attention to a particular element. Let me get that.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, where we're really headed with these questions boils down to the question of whether scarcity remains a significant problem. And we're talking today with Professor Richard Lanham, the author of the book, The Economics of Attention. Professor Lanham, are you back?
I'm here.
Conversation, great. What we're really drilling down on is the idea of how significant attention scarcity is today. And I guess I can jump to that question, which is, where do you think we are in that analysis?
Well, we don't have either more than 24 hours in a day or fewer than 24 hours in a day. In one way, you could say that the movement to a 24/7 schedule for practically everything is a way that allows people to, on the one hand, to feel that they have so many things to do they can't survive. On the other hand, to say that you can do the things that you want to do at times you want to do them, and so that you have been given a better return for your buck for the attention that you've paid to them. So it works both ways. It's part of this extraordinary paradox of plenty that we have not simply a lot more money than we used to have, but a lot more stuff than we used to have, but all these extraordinary diversions and interests, and you get perplexed by them, but at the same time you can make better use of them than people ever could before.
Right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, and so I think you have to be. Let me pull the oldest argument in the world and say you just have to be a little older in order to see this. I used to write books by hand. My handwriting is just horrible. You can't imagine it. My wife can tell you how hard it is. When I was always a fast typist, but I couldn't somehow bring myself to type on a typewriter because I had to erase everything. The computer came along, and I thought, hallelujah. I mean, this was an extraordinary expansion of my ability to put things down on paper. There have been all kinds of cases. I earned my living when I was in college as a draftsman.
Mm-hmm.
And you used to do that with pen and ink. And when you'd make a mistake and there was a blob on the drawing, you had to scrape it off or throw it over. And when I first came across the first computer drafting program, I thought, my God, this is paradise. And it really is. So there has been an extraordinary enhancement in the reward we get for paying attention to one thing rather than another, or our ability to pay attention to the vital thing rather than the peripheral thing, to the fact that you can just correct this error instantly in your drawing and don't have to spend 40 minutes scraping it and re-photographing it and doing all the things you used to have to do in those evil old days.
I had an experience early on in my legal career with a partner at a law firm who had been practicing for decades, who asked me to revise some documents, and I told him just casually that I would go ahead and type them into the document, and this partner closed the door behind me and said, David, you don't type. You give that to your assistant. Your assistant types, because lawyers don't type. And of course, you know, the difference was stark, because that concept had never occurred to me. And of course, you know, there wasn't an attorney in the office who had graduated law school anytime recently who wasn't typing everything. So it's interesting how people conceive even the technologies themselves and what role they play with people. Another interesting term that you've coined in the book, and I want to talk about a little bit, is the name attention economists. Maybe you could describe what you mean by that, and based upon that definition, I guess the question becomes, aren't we all podcasters, mashup artists, people in robots, hackers, etc. and so forth, attention economists?
Well, the short answer is sure, we all are. It's a big group. But let me cut me a little nomenclatural slack here.
Sure.
I know, even though you're a lawyer. all of us who are attention economists in one kind or another are part of the world of what is usually called the humanities. That is, we believe our economy is an economy of attention as against the economy of stuff, which is what real economists talk about. Yes, we all are. I mean, if you want to look at it historically, literature has been developed and taught as on the basis of rhetoric from the beginning. I don't know what a mashup artist is, but I'll assume that it's something like bloggers or all of
those. I can define it for you very quickly. It's the people that do kind of the video works where they put a piece of film and a different song together to make a new creation. Or recut film trailers to make them look like something else. The idea really is creating a new work out of existing video, music, film, and what have you.
Okay, well, sure. The reason why we're all of these things are so important to us is that in fact there has been this fundamental change in the economy and the people. Look, what used to happen in the I make this point apropos the university curriculum, but you can make it in other ways. In a economy based on stuff, ask yourself this question: what kind of subjects can you study that will make your parents happy when you come home from college and tell them about, or that will make them unhappy?
Mm-hmm.
And if you say, I'm going to be a nuclear physicist, or I'm going to be an economist, or I'm going to be a geologist, they'll say, oh, that's okay, man, you can get off the payroll. If you say, I'm going to be a poet, or I'm going to be an English professor, well, I don't know, you know. And that's because those subjects are at the periphery of interest and power in the economy, and it's the stuff that's at the middle. But what's happened now is that those two have reversed themselves. And so there will be a fundamental, sooner or later, it takes the university a long time to get used to these things, there will be a fundamental reversal in the center of gravity, and all those subjects which used to be at the periphery, which are all attention economists in some way, what we call the humanities, will move to the center, and the others are going to move to the edge. And neither side is ready for it, I think, or willing to acknowledge that it's taken place, but it's going to happen. It has to happen. I tried to make this point in a focused way by talking about Andy Warhol and Christo,
right,
as two artists who really both understood that in 20th century art is not about objects, but it's about attention. And so they decided they would create their art in human attention.
Right, and certainly anyone that saw the Gates exhibit in New York City Central Park a few years ago could recognize that principle at play.
Sure. Well, that's Christo's argument from the Christo's is making an argument for entrepreneurship. He's making a specific economic argument, and Warhol is making another one, which is the profitability of celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
So they really are perfect economists. Now, I don't know whether the art historian, if any art historians bother to read this book, I'm sure they come on me, down on me like a thousand bricks, because these people are masters of expression and so on. But, you know, first and foremost, they're economists of attention.
Right. The you mentioned earlier the Beatrice Ward poster, and I think it's such a great piece of text that I actually want to read it. You quote it on page 79 of your book, and I'll read it for the benefit of the listeners, and then ask a follow up question. So this is a poster that Beatrice Ward, the English type typographer, created in 1932. And the poster says, "This is a printing office, crossroads of civilization, refuge of all the arts against the ravages of time, armory of fearless truth against whispering rumor, incessant trumpet of trade. From this place, words may fly abroad, not to perish on waves of sound, not to vary with the writer's hand, but fixed in time, having been verified in proof. Friend, you stand on sacred ground. This is a printing office." And I can understand fully why you have that poster on your wall. Indeed, it's exactly the kind of thing I would put on my wall as well. And so I commend you on your interest in wall art. But I do want to ask you what I think is an interesting follow-up question, which is this: the topic and the subject of this poster was the monotype. And isn't, in fact, what we're talking about today, technology, the very antithesis of the monotype because of issues of degradation and the fact that things can fall apart? And how does this wonderful statement about a printing office fit into your view of the world?
Well, first of all, it is the perfect encapsulation of the world of the intellectual world based on print. It's fixed. This is where I started out in academic life. The first class I ever took in graduate school was a class in Renaissance literature. The center of Renaissance humanism, at least for literature, was reclaiming the classical texts of Latin and Greek literature and fixing them permanently in editions, making sure that these texts are recovered and fixed forever in a single form. So on the basis of that, a whole structure of authority is built up. What happens when you put them on the screen? People start fiddling around with them, and that whole structure of authority goes out the window. You mentioned monotype, but the whole idea of typography and type design, which used to be a very narrow field, Now the web is full of various typefaces. People have made it into a kind of amateur hobby. I don't know how many typefaces I have in my computer, maybe 75 or 80, and fiddle around with them from time to time. But what the Word text does is show the old fixed world, which has now been put into play in all kinds of ways. Now, if you ask me where my own heart and sympathy lie, it's with the Word statement. I mean, this is where I began, and this is where I return to. But on another wall in my computer room, I have a picture created by an artist named Stephen Rourke, but it's created by genetic algorithms. It's not created from the top down, but by evolving pictures, visual patterns from the bottom up. So it's the counter statement to this. And I am literally myself halfway between the two. And I sometimes look to one for inspiration and to the other. But you put your finger on a crucial point, because the whole history of style in verbal expression can be condensed into the argument about typefaces.
Mm-hmm.
If there are a few of them and you pay no attention to them and you look through them, then that's one way to think about reading a literary text. But if you say, well, this is a very interesting example of Ventana 27, or why don't you use a 12-point instead of 14-point, as my wife is always telling me, you're paying attention to it in a different kind of way, the same way that when you read a Virginia Woolf novel and you just bathe in the prose style. So the history of Beatrice Ward poster is also implicitly the history of prose style.
Right.
It's kind of fun.
Word that we had more time, I would delve more deeply. But in the remaining couple of minutes we have, I'd be remiss in not asking you, given your vast experience teaching, and given the technological changes that you've witnessed, I really want to get your thoughts on what you think of the digital or wired classroom, especially given your theories of attention.
Well, I want to turn the argument upside down. The ideal of a wired classroom is a series of desks on top of each of which sits a computer. And the students look at the computer screens instead of at the instructor, who is indeed looking at his or her computer screen. This seems to me 180 degrees wrong. The point of the digital revolution is to put the classroom in the computer, not the opposite. That doesn't make any sense to me. It seems to me a dreary pageant. If you were going to have live instruction, and I think it is just as important as everyone who argues for it says it is, then you have to make the most out of what it can do, and say there are also a number of things that it can't do or doesn't do very well. Let's put those on the screen. Classrooms are very expensive. You have to get students to go there. You have to build the buildings and so on. They have to go at a certain time. In the internet world of instruction, all that expense is done away with, and all kinds of other things can be done. My puzzlement is, why put the classroom, the computer in the classroom when you should do the opposite, and why not then mix online instruction with live instruction in interesting ways? Every time I go to a small liberal arts college, I ask them what they do with their classrooms in the summer, and the answer is usually nothing. And then I usually say, have you ever thought that you could use them in the summer as the perfect counterstatement or complement to online instruction of various sorts, that you could bring people who have been doing online interacting for 6 weeks or 6 months together for a week together to meet and talk about their subject in a classroom, and this would be a wonderful alternation. And I've not been successful in selling this product. You remember that? You probably don't. It's a great time. The great literary critic Northrop Frye says, when you teach a dead class, it makes you understand how electricity feels when it discharges into a non-conductor. And when I was making this argument, I've always been discharging into a non-conductor, and I never understood why. But.
On that note, we have to close, but it's, my perspective of technology is actually one that is not quite as rose-colored as you might assume, given my fellowship in the Center for Internet Society and the work that I do. I mean, I came at technology growing up with earlier versions of home computers, and so I grew up with a Commodore 64. But I experienced personally the strange impacts of technology, even as a resident director in an undergraduate dormitory at my law school, Case Western, where I was stunned to find that people who were sharing rooms, I mean, your roommates, were emailing each other while they were sitting in the room together. Now, that might be an extreme example of the behavior, but it does cause, one, the question, and certainly you can see if you visit virtually any modern classroom today, that that the computer, especially laptops with their instant messaging capabilities and what have you, create enormous potential diversions. And there really is a question as to what the technology does to add to learning. On the flip side, of course, is as we develop more technologies that allow for interactive learning through use of the computer, then you may be able to ameliorate some of the problems. But it's definitely an open question, and I certainly share your concern about it. Well, Richard, I want to thank you for being on today, discussing your book, The Economics of Attention, out of University of Chicago Press. It's been a great discussion, and I thank you for taking the time today.
I've been delighted to talk to you. Great fun.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks again to Professor Richard Lanham, author of the book, The Economics of Attention, out of University of Chicago Press, for being on today. I'm looking forward to upcoming interviews on Hearsay Culture. Coming up next week will be Julian Dibel, author of the book, Play Money, about actually creating a career selling virtual goods in virtual worlds. And then the following week, David Brin, author of the fascinating book, The Transparent Society. And I'm also looking forward to, at the end of the month, talking to Professor Mark Lemley, who is an international intellectual property law scholar here at Stanford Law School, about the myriad of issues kicking up intellectual property, especially the surprisingly numerous cases in the Supreme Court involving patent law. So I'm very excited to have Mark on the show at the end of February. As always, you can pick up this show and learn more about the show by going to CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. We also have the podcast up on iTunes as a podcast through the Center for Internet Society webpage. And I've also recently launched a website dedicated to the show, which is at www.hearsayculture.com, where you can also pick up the show, download the audio, find links, and really find more information about the show itself. So thank you again for listening today to Hearsay Culture. Please stay tuned to KZSU for its diverse programming. Coming up next is Mike with Baptism of Solitude, and I will look forward to talking to you next week.